Welcome to State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also now available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. DC 37 members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with your union. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net, and every month keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. If you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. Tonight, we're going to talk about taxes and about the attempts by the congressional Republicans to overhaul the tax code. Joining us by phone tonight from Washington, D.C. is AFSCME's Director of Government Affairs, Scott Fry. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, actually, Scott.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be with you.
I want to break down the fourth wall a little bit. This show is airing on Sunday nights, but we're taping actually a couple of days before Thanksgiving. And in this world in which we move, a couple of news may have gotten ahead of us at some point. But let's talk about the confusement that I have about the process. The Senate has a bill. The House just passed a bill. They have to reconcile the two bills. Where are we now in the process of this?
Sure. Well, just before the Thanksgiving break last week, the House voted 227-205 to approve a bill, which basically is a giveaway to the wealthiest Americans at the expense of the middle class. Under the rules of the Senate, the House bill increases the deficit by $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years and actually expands it further beyond that. The Senate, it's a complicated rules process, but in order to pass the vote without filibuster, meaning a simple majority of 50 or 51 votes, they had to make some changes in the out years, so the bill doesn't expand the deficit in the out years. They're very cosmetic. We still think it is going to explode the deficit in the out years. But in order to get a budget score, they have to do some things differently. There are some differences between the Senate approach and the House approach. The Senate's going to take up their bill as soon as they return, probably Monday or Tuesday, there's going to be a major debate in the Senate. It's going to be very close.
And when you talk about the out years, what is an out year?
I'm sorry. Yes. The first 10-year window is what is critical in this. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is the scorekeeper for legislation moving through Congress, pays attention to the first 10 years. The bill would expand the deficit over the next 10 years by $1.5 trillion. That's the limit in their budget agreement that the House and Senate set for themselves for deficit creation in this bill. If they exceed that, then they can't proceed in the Senate without the threat of Democrats staging a filibuster.
And if I remember correctly, deficits were a huge problem for Republicans when Barack Obama was president of the United States.
As we understood, and we expect as soon as this bill passes, which gives away massive, massive federal resources to the wealthiest Americans and corporations, they'll return to their concern for the deficit. In fact, Speaker Ryan has promised that in order to close that $1.5 trillion in deficits, they're going to revisit cuts to Medicare and Medicaid and other programs that are vital to the middle class.
Okay, I'm from Queens, and I worked on tabloid newspapers for years, and I think I know Donald Trump as a personality. But let's give credit where it's due. Donald Trump told Americans and working-class Americans that he was going to cut their taxes. Is he doing that?
Absolutely not. In fact, he will get a huge benefit, even just from the repeal of the estate tax alone. His children will benefit greatly. but fully half of Americans, 93 million households, will get a tax increase by 2027. The top 1% will see an average cut of $32,000 a year. The top 0.1% of wage earners would see a cut of $208,000 a year. But 87 million households earning less than $200,000 would get a tax increase under the Republican plan. Fully half of all the middle of American households will see their taxes go up by 2027 under this plan. And the reason for that is while the corporate breaks, reducing the corporate rate, and the other benefits to the high-income Americans will be permanent under this bill. In order to meet that 10-year window I talked about, they sunset all of the benefits in the bill that are designed for middle class, such as increasing the child deduction for child care and for the standard deduction. So they sunset the benefits for the middle class within the 10 years, so they can make permanent corporate tax breaks and breaks for the wealthiest Americans.
So the idea here, I'm just trying to understand their idea. I'm just trying to understand what they think they're going to accomplish with this. I can't even understand. I don't even get that. And I guess I'm back to, well, if the corporations do well and the richest do well, then the rest of us are going to get the droppings from that. Is that what their mindset is? Is that how this is a good thing for Americans, according to them?
Well, if you try to explain it based on policy, I think there's always been this idea that if you give away huge tax breaks to the wealthy and corporations, that it somehow trickles down to working people. As you know, that's never borne out. It didn't work under President Reagan and blew up the deficit for 20 years. It didn't work under George Bush. We created the economic crisis of 2008, and here we go again. On the other hand, I think that it was revealed, particularly by the chief economic advisor, Cohn, of the White House, Trump's economic advisor, that the people that really are excited about this are CEOs who are going to see a huge personal tax break out of this bill, and those are the major donors of the Republican Party, and those are the people that are anxious to see this bill pass.
And you say, and I want to go back to this, you say that Trump personally, well, obviously Trump is a wealthy guy. If this thing is going to favor the wealthy, then he's going to get tax breaks off of that. But he's also going to get, this is, and I know this from, again, having lived in New York City all my life and having worked on newspapers and watched, Donald Trump may be playing a big scale, but he's running a small business, and it's a family business. And his family is going to do very well under this plan.
No question about it. And we're reducing the corporate tax rate to 20% from 35%. It's got to benefit his corporations, but it just goes without. You don't need to see his tax returns to know that a man of his wealth is going to do tremendously well. Something else that's in this tax bill is worth noting as well is that they slashed the corporate tax rates for profits earned offshore, so that profits earned offshore will be taxed at a lower rate than profits earned in the United States, which will increase offshoring, ship more jobs overseas. So it has an actual negative effect on another Trump promise, which was to create jobs in the United States and stop the bleeding of jobs abroad. I mean, there's nothing good in this tax bill for middle-class workers.
And is it true, that they were giving tax breaks on private planes or something at some point?
There are a number of benefits that let me walk through this real quickly.
Please,
if you are, one of the deductions they take away for working people is a deduction for union dues, but they continue to allow employers to deduct the cost of lawyers to fight union contracts. They are going to be eliminating deductions for work-related expenses for workers. Teachers spend a lot of money out of their own pocket in the public school systems to make sure their students have a good experience in the classroom. They will lose the deduction they currently get for that. But at the same
time... Hold it. My mother was a teacher. My sister is a teacher. You're telling me that the money that they spend to get supplies and other things into the classroom for their kids that aren't reimbursed by the school can no longer be deducted as a business expense?
Can no longer be deducted as a business expense. But corporations who expense the business will continue to be allowed to have that deduction. I mean, the list goes on and on. They're just dropping deductions. The state and local taxes, which is a killer for New York. New Yorkers, on average, will pay $4 billion over the next 10 years in increased taxes because of the loss of the deduction for state and local taxes paid.
Let me. We're talking with AFSCME's Director of Government Affairs, Scott Fry. In addition to the tax plan, and again, I don't want to talk about personality. I want to talk about policy. The Trump administration policies in the first year, and we just have a few minutes left to talk about this. Tell me about how they, beyond the tax plan, how they have been designed to hurt working Americans.
Well, again, you know, what we're seeing is they're going after the Affordable Care Act. They're going after health care benefits. They're proposing to deep cuts in Medicaid and Medicare to pay for their tax cuts. Their top priority is this tax proposal. It always has been. We're seeing attacks on workers current legislation moving through Congress that would undermine workers' rights related to joint employer relationships. When you're working for a franchise, you don't have any rights under the bill that they want to propose. Obama had tried to expand those rights, and then they're trying to reverse anything positive that happened for working people over the last 8 years.
And more Americans than ever are signing up for Obamacare, and they keep on trying to kill it.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the latest insult in this tax bill. The Senate, in order to save a little bit more money, is going after what's known as the individual mandate. The people that don't buy insurance are required to buy it under the Affordable Care Act. That will actually reduce, throws 13 million Americans off of health insurance, but, you know, worse still, it would raise premiums on average, according to the Joint Tax Committee, the nonpartisan Joint Tax Committee, by 10% on average across the board. The premiums go up, coverage goes down. One more attempt to undermine our health care to pay for these tax cuts for the very wealthy.
You know, every once in a while, I'll get an email from someone saying, why is the union focused so much on politics? Why aren't you guys just taking care of more bread and butter issues? And politics is the bread and butter issue, right? I mean, all things flow from the decisions that are made in the voting booth.
Well, that's right. The ballot box and the bread box, they're closely linked. Economic justice is very, very much tied to, currently, as I said, that vote was very close in the House. In the Senate, it may come down to one or two, perhaps three votes, one way or the other. Tax cuts, as far as the eye can see, for the wealthiest Americans, and benefit cuts, as far as the eye can see, for everyone else. And they're just going to exacerbate the current disparity between the wealthiest 1% and everybody else in this country if they proceed down this path. So it's very critical who gets elected to office and who's making these decisions for the American people.
We're talking with AFSCME's Director of Government Affairs, Scott Fry. I knew this conversation would go by very quickly. Thank you for helping enlighten us and setting the record straight on what's going on in D.C. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. Joining us now by phone is author and Teamsters Local 810 General Counsel Mark Torres. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Your latest book, we did a review of this book in the DC 37 Public Employee Press in the November issue. The book is called Good Guy Jake, Buen Chico Jake. It's about a sanitation worker who repairs and paints broken toys he finds on his route and gives them to children at a local shelter for Christmas. But it's about much more than that. Good, welcome to the show, and let's talk about it.
Great. Thanks for having me. And, Good Guy Jake is definitely a labor of love. It's, as you indicated, it's a children's book. It's aimed to teach children, younger children, what about the labor movement and what unions do. But you know, and told in a story that they can relate to. It's, as you said, it's a sanitation worker who taking broken toys from the curb. Unfortunately, it's a violation of a work rule, so he loses his job over it. He goes to the union, he files a grievance, and then arbitration, and he has to go to the arbitration right around the Christmas time, so it's a very Christmas time feel to it. And then some of the children testify in his behalf of how he taught them the meaning of Christmas, and even though he broke a rule, it wasn't meant to hurt anyone, and it's a real heartwarming story.
And it's in two languages. It's in English and Spanish. And you are the general counsel of a Teamsters local. What are you doing writing children's books?
Well, initially the idea was pitched to me by the publisher, Tim Sheard of Hardball Press. And he had come to me knowing my union background. And quite frankly, it came easy because that's really pretty much what we do. Labor counsel represent employees in all different kinds of matters. And telling this story was a natural for me, although it was a bit of a challenge to write for children, and we had to simplify the terms from an arbitrator and a grievance, something that children can relate to. So it was a natural fit in that regard.
I edit the union newspaper, do the show, do a lot of the communications work with the communications team at DC 37, and there are folks from some of the more senior folks at DC 37 have come to me from time to time bemoaning the fact that there is no labor education in schools. There is no way for young people. Now, I think mainly we're talking about younger workers, that there is no real opportunity for younger workers to have an appreciation of where the labor movement comes from. You have taken it a step even further. You've gone into, 8-year-olds and 7-year-olds, and you're saying this is what unions are about. That's a fascinating concept.
Sure. Thank you. And it was aimed in that direction. And you're 100% correct. A lot of the manuals and information out there is more just that, manuals and training material. We wanted to tell a story firsthand that children can relate to. And I could tell you, just a few weeks ago, I went to my daughter's class in fifth grade, and I read the book to the class, and they all loved it. And at the end, I asked, do you think that Jake would have gotten his job back if he wasn't in the union? And they all raised their hand and said no. So they're getting the message very early and understanding the value and benefit of being in a union in a fun and compelling way.
I want to set the stage a little better for listeners. You are a labor lawyer. You've been doing labor law for a number of years. How long have you been at the Teamsters?
Well, actually, prior to joining Local 810, I was actually a member of Local 810 for almost 20 years. I used to work at New York University as a refrigeration engineer. So I have a unique perspective of understanding what it's like to be in the working man's shoes, and now as attorney representing those same people that I used to work with, gives me that unique perspective.
And how does a labor lawyer get involved in writing novels? This is your second book. Tell us about your first book, and tell us about how you get the time to live in both worlds.
Yeah, the art is definitely in the juggling. And my first book, released in December of 2015, is entitled A Stirring in the North Fork. It's available on Amazon. And that was a murder mystery. It was a crime novel. And, you know, it actually only took me a relatively short time, less than 5 months, to write that book and release it and self-publish it. And people ask, how do you have the time? And I always think back to my law school days. When I went to law school, I went to law school in the evening, and I worked full-time in the day. So having gone through that, you know, writing and doing all this extracurricular stuff comes relatively easy.
And when did you write the first novel again? You wrote it in 2015, and you say just wrote it in a few weeks?
It was about less than 5 months to finish from start to finish and publish it. And I worked on it with my wife. We collaborated on the story and the artwork, and we self-published it. And again, it was a labor of love, just wanting to tell a story of obviously a fictional tale of a cold case murder in Long Island that happened in 1972. And an out-of-work attorney, much like myself at one time, was looking for a cause, if you will. And he stumbled on the case and went out to the North Fork of Long Island to just trace the path of the murder to try to see if he can reach some justice almost four decades later.
And you say you worked on this book with your wife, which means you didn't have to explain long weekends alone in a room writing. That was a smart move, collaborating with your...
Well, no, and I mean, she was integral because my wife has that forensic mind, and it was helpful to write. And I'll tell you, it was a break from legal writing, because as you write as a lawyer, you're to the point, you're concise, you're kind of constrained by the rules of legal writing. Writing that book and now this one is fun because it's liberating. You can kind of go on tangents. You can have the freedom to express, although through fiction. But what was challenging was to be more descriptive. You know, don't tell me, show me. And that was the descriptive writing aspect that I had to work on and develop.
And where does your writing career take you going forward? Are there going to be more labor-related stories? Are you interested in doing other crime novels? Are you? One other question. The question is about self-publishing. Is that something that is happening more and more in the world in which we live?
It is. I mean, at the time, I was an unknown and still to some degree an unknown, a new author. And, you know, when I pitched the manuscript to several publishers, that, you know, if they don't know you or sense an opportunity for really large profits, they're not going to touch it. So I wound up going the self-publishing route through Amazon. It was really the only choice I had to get out my work. And really, I had no problems with it. Once it was done, it was just marketing on myself. And it never, ever, up until this day, feels like a job because it's really a labor of love. You put out your work. You write what you know, and then you market it. And for the first book, A Stirring in the North Fork, I had entirely social media-driven marketing efforts. And I had asked readers, you know, wherever you go, post a picture with the book. And within a year, the book was pictured on every continent on Earth. I can remember December of 2016, literally the one-year anniversary, a reader from Antarctica was on a trip to Antarctica and posted a picture on an ice shelf, and it was just incredibly humbling to see that your books made it all the way around the world.
The world has become a smaller place, Mark.
Yeah, that's true.
And Good Guy Jake, Wayne Chico Jake, is available. How do listeners, now, first of all, listeners who are members of DC 37, this book has been reviewed in the Public Employee Press in the November issue. So please, if you've got a copy or if you want to go online and take a look at it, Molly Charbonneau, our writer, thought it's a terrific book. And it really does break ground in terms of making a connection for young people about the positive role that unions play in workers' lives. And my question to you, sir, is how do folks get this book?
It is available through Hardball Press, the publisher's website, which Tim shared. His author has released numerous books on social justice and union causes. I highly recommend reviewing that website. It's also available on Amazon.
Hardball
and I'll
Press.
Also share one thing we're quite proud of. Just yesterday, we finished up a meeting. I was with Tim, and we're donating 200 books to the United Federation of Teachers in Puerto Rico. We were told by that union, we contacted that during Hurricane Maria, they lost mostly all of their reading materials. So when we heard that, we felt, I mean, compelled and thrilled to donate these books to the children in Puerto Rico to have not only reading material, but also further the union cause there as well. As you know, Teamsters have several locals in Puerto Rico as well as in Canada and throughout the country. So it's important to continue spreading the message. And I'll also, lastly, point out that it's not, obviously, it's not just I'm a Teamster attorney, Teamster member, but this is union labor movement through and through. This appeals across all lines to every union. It's an overall global message and a positive one, like you said. It's about time we've had some positivity in the movement.
And how important it is, talk a little bit about how important you think it is to write positive stories about unions, especially since...
I mean, look, we've been beaten down. We've been tried to, we're almost cast aside as a political party. And I hate to see that because members are, they come from all walks of life, all different places and locations and beliefs, whether it's religious, political. What unites them all is a union. And as I explained even to my daughter's class, is, you know, everywhere you go, when people work, they have and need rights. And that's where a union comes in. It could be a teacher, a fireman, a policeman, a factory worker. They all have and need rights. And that's our job to protect and really enhance those rights for all those workers. And, you know, teaching children at a young age, really at any age, is an important, strong message to develop. And not just tell it in a manual transcript kind of way. Tell it in a story that people can relate to.
That's right. It is about, everything's about telling stories. And in the world in which we live now, right, it's very hard to get folks' attention. So it's important to be as compelling as possible. This is completely a different, as I say, I haven't seen anything like this in years, where you're actually reaching out to very young folks and giving them a glimpse of a world they probably would not even have thought about.
Absolutely.
If this,
and even members ourselves, you know, they have the busy days, busy schedules. They get home from work. They're helping children with homeworks. And, you know, the office is for a business agent, you know, wherever someone else works. They travel, they go to and fro. And really, the book was dedicated to all those, you know, dedicated to the labor movement, from the offices of a union to clerical to staff. Anyone who really takes part in protecting someone else's livelihoods is critical, important.
Well, listen, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Good Guy Jake, Buen Chico Jake is the name of the book. It's published by Hardball Press. There is a website. Do you know the website name again?
It's Hardball, just the Hardball Press. That'll give you right to the link.
Hardballpress.com.
Yes, correct.
That is. And also, Mark is the author of Killing on the North Fork. Is that the name? Stirring on the North Fork. That is also available online through Amazon.
That's correct.
Mark Torres, General Counsel of Teamsters Local 810. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We are just about out of time. Before we go, a couple of announcements. Find out about the latest issues impacting our union by attending an organizing department meeting at your job site. For dates and locations, call 212-815-1095. Share the holiday spirit with less fortunate members of our union family and participate in DC-37's annual holiday drive sponsored by the Personal Services Unit and the Municipal Employee Legal Services. For more details, check out November's Public Employee Press. And if you want to learn about purchasing your first home or refinancing, attend the DC-37 Municipal Employees Housing Program Housing Seminar on Friday, December 12th at 5:30 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For more information, call 212-815-1814. I want to thank our guests, AFSCME's Director of Government Affairs, Scott Fry, and author Mark Torres for joining us this evening. And if you have any comments, stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.